The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I begin with thanking you for being here for the day. Some of you came all day and some maybe came for the afternoon or part of it. But thank you. I very much appreciate the opportunity to do these kinds of day-long retreats, and hopefully it's been meaningful for you. So I'd like to start this talk with a kind of an analogy, a little story, analogy, I guess, that the analogy of the ant and the elephant. If a big, like a horsefly or something, lands on an ant, it's kind of a big deal for the ant. It might even make the ant's life difficult. If that same fly lands on an elephant, it's not even a small deal for the elephant. It's like nothing. The elephant goes about its life quite content. So the question is, do we want to go through our life as an ant or like an elephant? And this analogy is a little bit building on the ancient Buddhist tradition that one of the words for elephant, sometimes in these ancient texts, is naga. And sometimes the people who become mature in this practice are called nagas. Sometimes it means a serpent, but sometimes it refers to it being like an elephant. So maybe that's a little different than how many people think of Buddhist practice, when there's an excessive emphasis on not-self. It would seem like we're supposed to just kind of disappear, like we're supposed to be nobody, going nowhere, doing nothing, like basically somehow not be there. But they become an elephant, become a serpent, and they to become big, so big that we're not troubled by things of the life. That's a very different orientation than let's find the wisdom, let's find the insight, let's get the kind of freedom in my mind or my heart so that I could be happy. That's true for practice. But there's a whole other kind of orientation that's maybe is a nice challenge for all of us. This idea that part of the reason why life is a lot easier for people who mature in this practice is they get to be big. And you get to be big. You get to count. You get to be important in a certain way. You are able to be someone who inhabits yourself fully. You don't have to diminish yourself or not count. You count. The more free you are. When I was living at the Zen monastery in California, I went there to practice Zen, which I thought was a lot of Zen meditation. So I was there about 9 months, practicing away, doing the meditation. And then they had the time came in the fall to go into an intensive period of retreat for 3 months. And that meant a lot of meditation. And the time day came where everyone was assigned their monastic jobs for that period. And I was assigned to the kitchen. And when you work in the kitchen, you don't get to meditate so much. And like kitchen, cooking, that's not Zen. So I was, as young Gil, I was like, oh no, this is not right. I had never done much cooking before, especially in an industrial-sized kitchen. So I went into the kitchen to work the first day. And the kitchen just seemed so big. And I felt so small. Like, what do I do? Where do I find myself? Where's anything? And I just felt like a teeny little person in this big kitchen and intimidated by it. I worked in that kitchen for a whole year. And it was pretty much to the day, a year later, was going to be my last day in the kitchen. And before I left the kitchen, I was the last person to leave for the day. I stood and looked around, remembering how I looked around the year before. And I thought, this kitchen has gotten a lot smaller. It's not so big anymore. So one of us had changed. The kitchen or me. And so I didn't exactly feel big, but I felt somehow the contrast with the kitchen was quite telling. Now I had confidence, I knew the place, I felt comfortable there, I knew how to get around. And so my whole sense of self, or, you know, being, it was almost like I was a different size. So in the teachings of the Buddha, I'd like to propose that one of the ways that we mature in this practice happens when we take on a different framework with which to understand ourselves and our life, different than we usually do. Some of the frameworks, some of the orientations, perspectives we use to see ourselves is not that useful. And so, for example, some of us have been victims of things that have happened. But to use that as the perspective to understand ourselves, like, I'm the victim. You know, these days I'm the victim of old age and sickness. This is a crime against humanity. Someone should get my fury and my blame, and, you know, someone has to fix it because I'm the victim. And so that's an example of going a little bit too far with this victimhood. There are ideas that we are inadequate. We're not up to what it takes to get through life. There's attitudes, many attitudes we carry about ourselves, ways we see ourselves, which undermine ourselves, that limit ourselves, that sees us in a very narrow point of view. There are delusions of grandeur that people live in. You know, I'm probably I'm probably the next Buddha. And so suddenly, as grand as that is, it's also a very limited perspective to use. These aren't fair, to cover the range of perspectives people have. But there's many perspectives that limit us, lock us in, makes us ants in a sense. Is there a different way they can make us elephants in our own life? So the Buddha is offering a different framework, a different perspective with which to see our experience. And it's helpful to understand it that way. It's really a different perspective than what's usual. It was probably very different back in India, in ancient India, 2,500 years ago, what he was teaching then as well. And it's the perspective that a perspective which kind of cuts through a lot of the these unhelpful frameworks we use, unhelpful beliefs we use to understand ourselves, the world around us, other people. We have to find some way to get underneath them or cut through them or not be stuck in always seeing through their lens. And I've told this many times, but when I was a new student of Zen, guilt was such a big phenomena for me that I thought Gil was short for guilt. And that I would literally feel guilty walking, how I walked across the meditation hall floor. I mean, why would you feel guilty for that? I had to walk across it, but somehow it was so deeply ingrained in me. So I saw myself through the lens of my guilt. Somehow that I'm wrong, and not just wrong, but I'm a kind of a criminal. And so that was not a very good way to live. It was very limiting and all that. So is there a different perspective? Is there something that cuts through that, that kind of shatters it or thaws it or lets it evaporate or disappear? And there is. And that's what I think what the Buddha, when the Buddha offered the four foundations of mindfulness, he was actually offering an alternative framework to understand our life. So it isn't just a simple practice to do. It's actually bigger than that. It's more monumental. It's actually offering you different eyes with which to see your life. It's not necessarily the perfect way to see life. It's not like this is what you're supposed to do, you know, the only way. It's just a very effective way if what you want to do is to break out of the trap that our self-concepts have often put us in. If you want to break out of the trap of the very narrow view of life that is provided by greed or hatred, resentments, fears, all those emotions put lens, glasses on our eyes, and we see the world in a particular way. We see it through guilt or fear or shame or greed or anger or resentment. But how do we break through that, break out of it? And so by trying a different perspective out. So the four foundations of mindfulness is usually called, and I talked about it this morning, I thought I'd do it again. And so so to see them more, as I said, than just practices, they're alternative ways of viewing ourselves, viewing our experience. And so that might give you a different appreciation for what we're doing when we're practicing mindfulness. It gives you, it's actually richer, it's fuller, it's like actually much more is going on than simply being mindful of what is. It's being mindful of what is through a new perspective. And I would venture to say that for the Buddha, this was a better perspective than most you could use, and especially if what you want to do is to become free. Probably none of you want to be an elephant, but if you want to kind of, just really set yourself free in some deep, deep inner way. So these four perspectives, there's many other ways to see our lives. And some people look at these four foundations of mindfulness and say, well, all kinds of things are left out. They are. But maybe maybe some of them are important in their own way. But if you want to do the job right, these are the most useful tools. So you might need a screwdriver, you might need a hammer, you might need a chisel, you might need a saw for the job you're going to do. But you might not need a jackhammer. Don't go carrying a jackhammer around all the time. If you do, you probably don't have enough strength to carry all the other tools that you do need. So there are a place for jackhammers, but it's not necessarily the best tool to have to do, the fine work on your house. Go into your kitchen to fix the sink with a jackhammer. These four foundations are like the tools that they're not meant to cover everything exactly in a certain way. On the other hand, they do cover everything because this is the perspective with which to look at whatever is happening. So whatever is happening, we look at it through the lens of what's happening in the body. What's the physical experience like? What are the sensations like? what's happening with our breathing as we're doing it. Come into the body and get to know that. Know that well. Relax into the body, open into the body. The body is not a hunk of flesh and bone. The body is a whole complicated or rich environment of sensations and sensing and feeling and knowing. And there's a huge interplay and interactive relationship between what happens in the body, our belly, our hearts, our muscles, and what goes on in our brains, our minds. So if we don't really open up into our body in a full way, we're shortchanging ourselves from so much of the information that this body will provide us to find our way through life. More importantly, if we don't include our whole body as part of the practice can't really have its full effect on us. So the first foundation is to really begin cultivating an attention to the body, attention to the body breathing, attention to the sensations of the body, opening up and expanding the range of how well you can experience and feel the body. Imagine that there's an elephant that really believed it was an ant. Because when it paid attention, it just felt a teeny little, all it felt was a teeny little piece of the end of its trunk. So it thought that's who it was. Because it was repressed, it had shut out, it was distracted from knowing the rest of itself. That's kind of a pity. So the elephant has to fill out. So mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness of the body sensations, the experience of the body, is not a story. It's actually something much deeper than the story. It's definitely a process, so you can make a story out of it if you want, but the body is a processing phenomena. And so to really trust that how the body processes is a great gift of mindfulness. So the first of these new orientations is to really get oriented around how it is in your body. The second is what's called vedana, feeling tones. And this is, in one way, a radically simple thing to do. From another point of view, kind of a real big change of perspective. The simple thing is the idea that all experiences are either pleasant or unpleasant, or neutral, but those are rare. Or all experiences are comfortable or uncomfortable. A sense of ease or a sense of unease that goes with it. To see the experience we're having from that lens makes it, some situations, so much easier. We could be in a very difficult social problem, social event, maybe a difficult conversations with a group of people, they're yelling and screaming, and it's uncomfortable for sure. And it's very hard to figure out what to do. And if your figuring out mind is trying to analyze and understand what to do and who does what and all that, it can give you a headache. But Buddha says, remember, feel the body. And then feel, is this a pleasant and unpleasant situation? Oh, this is unpleasant. It's just unpleasant. What if I just see it as unpleasant? I know how to be present for the unpleasant. I know how to be uncomfortable. I can breathe. I can relax. And so instead of being involved in the complexity of the social event, we find our grounding, we find our ease, we find our simplicity. Oh, it's just uncomfortable. I can just I can step away, I can breathe, I can relax. It's actually easier just see it as uncomfortable than see it as a, you know, complicated social event. Maybe it is a complicated social event, and maybe sooner or later you have to figure it out. But for the purposes of this practice of becoming free and becoming an elephant, you're better off keeping it really simple and finding your grounding, finding your attention, finding yourself here more fully. And one of the ways to do that is to feel whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, and then just, okay, I'll just be with it at that level. That simple. What's a little more complicated about this instructions is the Buddha goes on to say there are two different areas to do this mindfulness of feelings and feeling tones. One is the pleasant, unpleasant things that are a consequence of what happens to us. The weather turns cold and it's unpleasant. The weather heats up and it's pleasant. Someone's using a jackhammer in the kitchen next door to you and it's unpleasant. And so the senses are stimulated. The other category has to do with the sense of what goes on in the inside of us, what we could maybe call the quality of our inner life, independent of what happens around us in the world. And some of us carry with us a quality of inner life that's not so comfortable. We might have a wonderful external situation, but internally, like when I was younger, I'm carrying this inner sense of guilt, which led to kind of heaviness, a kind of sense of being torn in my chest and my heart. It was kind of a difficult thing to carry. It didn't matter what was going around with me. But as we practice, as we live in our goodness, as we live with wholesomeness, there could be a shift and we start feeling wholesome, pleasant sensations that are not stimulated by the world around us, but are stimulated by the inner goodness within us. And this is a radical thing to do, to even assume, to recognize that there is something deeper in our hearts, in the quality of our being, that only we are responsible for. No one else can be responsible for the quality of our inner life. If you make someone else the custodian of the quality of your inner life, you've actually kind of given yourself away in some way, expecting other people to do it for you. And so for the Buddha, you want to kind of, part of this new perspective is to really look and see what's happening in here with me. And then keep it simple. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? Even to say that it's guilt maybe is too complicated. It's kind of a radical simplicity that we're working with that somehow cuts through the complexity that we get caught in. And sometimes, and what happened with me is I started going into Buddhist practice more and more and more, the quality of that inner life started to feel pleasant, started to feel wholesome, started to feel kind of a wonderful place to live. This was a surprise to me. I had no idea I had this capacity. And as that opened up, that created a very different perspective with which to understand myself. When I was always understanding it through the filter of my guilt, things didn't look so good. But when I started to feel a sense of well-being welling up inside, it created a different orientation, a different way, perspective to continue with the exploration. Then the Buddha suggested the third foundation, that the general state of mind that we live in, is the mind caught up in anything? Is it caught in greed? Is it caught in hatred? Is it caught in delusion? Or not? And you can somehow feel that sometimes. You can recognize, oh, there I'm caught. Oh, there it is. I was going along my life just happily and, then now I'm caught. And I better go to the store and get more cookies. Doesn't matter, the store is closed, but I will go find one no matter what. I'm capable, good, capable person. I know how to find an open store. And, it might take a couple hours, but you're determined. Caught by greed, caught by some kind of insatiable desire that has to happen now. There's nothing in the Buddha's teaching that says feel bad about yourself if you have greed. All he does amazingly, he says, Just know it. That's it. Just know it. Just know it. And then know whether the mind is contracted, the mind state, or expansive. And it's fascinating as we develop mindfulness to do the exercise of just wait around. It'll happen sooner or later. Wait for some time when you get really caught up in your thoughts, like you're really locked in and lost in your thoughts. When you notice that's happened, say, great, Gil gave me this exercise. And the exercise is to try to, as soon as it happens, feel, recognize what it's like to be caught in your thoughts. What does it feel like on the inside? How is it to be caught in your thoughts? Take your time to really get to know that. Because if you know what that's like, then it's be much more meaningful to recognize what it's like to not be caught in your thoughts and see the difference between the two. And what some people report, it doesn't have to be, this doesn't have to be your report, but some people report that when they're caught in their thoughts, their sense of awareness, their sense of who they are, their world has gotten really narrow. Some people say it's like the lights went out. It's gotten dark. And when they're back and being mindful, it feels like they're more expansive awareness, and it feels like the light is on. They can see. Some people, there feels a lot of pressure and tension when they're caught up. And when they're not caught, there's the absence of pressure and tension. So is the mind expansive or is it narrow? Is the mind agitated or is it calm? Is the mind settled or is it unsettled? Is the mind caught up in things or is it not caught up in things? What's, I think, brilliant about these kinds of questions the Buddha kind of asks us to look at, he's not asking us to fill any details. He's not asking us to be exactly specific what we're caught up in, what we're agitated about. You know, human beings get agitated. Don't give so much credence to the subject of the agitation, the subject of the greed. It's a distraction. It might be actually much more powerful and goes direct to the issue. Just know it as greed. Just know it as being unsettled. For many people, like if you're like me when I was younger, as soon as I knew what it was about, I would proliferate all these thoughts, ideas, self-criticism. How could I, you know, want cookies at midnight? You know, what a terrible person I am, want cookies, and why am I doing wanting cookies? And if you want to become free, just know it as greed and leave it at that. And then practice with that. Practice with the greed. Breathe with it, see it, find yourself free of it. And that then goes into the fourth foundation, which is to give you the full layout of the fourth foundation of mindfulness is kind of a lot of stuff, but I like to simplify it to its simplest elements. It's to notice when you're attached and when you're not. To notice you're clinging or notice when you're not clinging. So that makes things really simple. And so if you're clinging, then know you're clinging. If you're attached, if you're not clinging, know you're not clinging. And then get to know what it feels like, what these states are like. Non-clinging comes with a lot of beneficial states. So you can start to know those states. Clinging comes with a lot of not-so-nice things. Get to know them. This is a path by getting to know and understanding so that you become familiar enough that you're less likely to be tricked into the unwholesome things and more likely to know how to open to the wholesome things. So those are the four foundations of mindfulness. And so it's possible when anything goes on, you go through, you do a checklist. Okay, how is it in my body? What's the feeling tone? What's the mind state? Is there any clinging? is there non-clinging? If the answer is, I don't know, just let it be that way. Okay, so right now I didn't see any, either way. So if you get caught in thought, how does that feel in your body? What's the feeling tone of it? What's the mind state that comes with it? Is there any clinging or not clinging? If there's a huge volcanic explosion of emotions, okay, let's go through the list. Well, how is it like in the body? What's the feeling tone? What's the mind state? What's the clinging? If it's intense sensations like pain in the body, what's it like for the body? Is it pleasant or unpleasant? What's the mind state? Is there clinging or not clinging? And then we learn to practice with these things. We learn to find how we can accompany ourselves, be present for, listen, see, know better what's going on. And this accompanying experience has much more value if we're present in our whole body with it. If we're accompanying it from some disembodied sense of self, it doesn't carry a lot of value. But if we accompany stuff through the body, feel it and sense it, oh, this is what it's like, then whatever other ways we know it, like know it through the mind as well, the mind's eye, it has much more value. And so the mindfulness itself is meant to be very simple. What we're mindful, the lens through or the framework through which we are mindful, for the Buddha is these four areas. And as it develops, and this is like the North Star, the guiding principle for doing all this that kind of helps guide us, is we're coming into a way that we're not resolving all the issues in our life, but rather we're developing a heightened capacity to be aware. The awareness becomes clear. Awareness becomes less reactive. Awareness becomes kind of more expansive, more spacious. There's breathing room. There's awareness room for our experience. And as we do that, awareness doesn't stick to things so much. And as awareness becomes bigger and more free and more open and more simple and simple and simple, then you might slowly discover that you become an elephant. Or to say it differently, because some of you don't want to be an elephant, is that you might notice that your kitchen has gotten small and you've gotten big. Like the world is not so frightening anymore, it's not so overwhelming anymore, that something inside of you has grown and developed and can hold it. Your capacity to be here has become strong. So that when you find yourself in those very complicated, difficult social situations, you don't rush headlong into solving them with one offer your argument, but rather you know how to ground yourself, center yourself, you know how to be an elephant so that it's just a little fly on your back, everyone arguing around you. And then you might be in a better position to be supportive and helpful. And it might be, it just might be that in that particular complicated social argument, conflict that's going on, what the situation needs the most is one person who's calm. One person that can hold the space. Families can be very complicated. There's a principle in certain kinds of family therapy that if one family member can practice non-reactive awareness, the whole family moves towards health. So maybe you'll be the elephant that settles the room down, because you've learned a different perspective, a different orientation by which to understand your life, so you can get right to the heart of the matter quickly. The heart of the matter is to not be caught in your anxiety, not be caught in your desires, your hatred, yourself, your conceit. You can just be here in a simple, very direct way, and maybe you'll see more clearly what is it you can do to help and support. So I hope this makes sense to you, that we're developing a new perspective. And as much as we are cultivating and developing more and more mindfulness or concentration, and that you're practicing this different perspective as you go through your life. And this might make the whole mindfulness enterprise just a little bit richer and more full and more valuable for you to see it that way. I hope that's the case. So thank you, and thank you for being here. And as was the custom before the pandemic, these day-longs, at the end of the day, I asked for a few people to stay behind to do the final tidying up here. And we have 4 bathrooms. We usually tidy up clean. And I don't know, I haven't seen the kitchen, but it might need to be tidied up. We usually vacuum this floor, and we often take out the trash. And so it's usually about 6-7 people who stay behind. And since we're ending 10 minutes early, it usually takes about 10 minutes to do it. Are there 6-7 people who'd be willing to stay and help? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Thank you very much. And if you have a question about where to go or what to do, you're the one? So Kevin will answer your questions. Or Sveta knows a lot too. So thank you all very much.